From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Naples documentary producer Marina Berkovich recently completed what was probably the toughest interview of her life. A Russian TV network assigned the Jewish-Russian refugee to talk to a notable Holocaust denier who's spending the summer in Florida. He claimed to have a lock of Hitler's hair, and she was to get reaction from him about a recent DNA test showing Hitler's wife, Eva Braun, was of Jewish descent. We'll speak with her about how the interview changed her. Plus, Joel Davis of Port Charlotte was the only U.S. youth representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict in London this year. Last year, he was just graduating high school and took some time off before attending college. While working for a nonprofit, he was introduced to the topic. At the summit, he interviewed the likes of Secretary of State John Kerry and actress Angelina Jolie. We'll talk with Davis about his year addressing sexual violence and conflict. First, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Topher Forges. Last year, Joel Davis graduated from Port Charlotte High School. His plan was to head to Oxford University, but as college approached, Davis opted to defer for a year and instead took an internship at Physicians for Human Rights, a nonprofit organization that works with victims of sexual violence and conflict. Davis would find himself almost a year later acting as the only United States youth representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict in London. Throughout this year, Davis has also worked for the Middle East Institute covering issues in Syria, written and presented a paper on masculinity and sexual violence and conflict, and addressed the UN Women Assembly twice. Joel Davis joins us in the studio today. Joel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join our conversation. Call 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send an email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment at Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Or join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And I want to warn listeners that our discussion with Joel Davis may not be appropriate for younger audiences. So let's start at the beginning. After you graduated, what made you want to take time off?
Well, initially I had wanted to really dive into human rights issues, and I had felt that a little bit unprepared going into college without any real experience with working on the issues that I was so interested in. So I had thought that Oxford University, which is a great institution, it seemed a little bit too confining for me, too confining in just law studies for 3 years. So I had wanted to do more, I had wanted to learn more, and I felt a little bit unprepared going into the college process. So initially I had looked for internships and I had planned on deferring, and that's when I came across Physicians for Human Rights and working for as an intern for their Director of International Policy.
And why that organization?
Physicians for Human Rights has several great programs. They're a nonprofit human rights organization, and they're really dedicated to using science and medicine to documenting human rights violations. And what appealed to me especially was their program on sexual violence in conflict zones, which I knew was a great program that they had been running for a few years already, and that it was really a topic that I wasn't that familiar with, and I'd really wanted to learn more about, because sexual violence isn't something that you hear everybody talking about. It's something that most people would prefer to actually shy away from.
And what was your immersion into that topic like?
Well, initially I'd done lots of programmatic assistance with the sexual violence program. So that entailed research, helping collect data and evidence, really going through decades worth of papers and research specifically on the sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, helping to listen and transcribe interviews with people who are actually affected by sexual violence in these areas, in these conflict zones. And it really opened my eyes to a whole new world that I wasn't exposed to going through school or reading anything anywhere in the United States about this whole epidemic of using rape as a weapon of war.
And that, what is the definition of sexual violence and conflict?
So sexual violence and conflict, it's most often associated, I think, with the use of rape as a weapon of war. So when we think of rape, I think the problem with assuming that rape and sexual violence is used for some reason as something to do with sexual desire. It has nothing to do with sexual desire, and it has everything to do with power and humiliation, and it's used as a tactic to degrade people and to terrorize the civilian population. And it's something that we don't think about, but rape is it's inexpensive. It's an effective biological weapon. It really ensures that the least amount of harm comes to the perpetrator of rape and ensures that the most amount of harm comes to the population and to the people affected, and it can incur mass psychosocial trauma on huge populations while doing minimal damage to the rapists themselves. And it's seen as a real tactic and a strategy, especially in these areas that lack critical infrastructure.
And while you were getting introduced to this topic at the Physicians for Human Rights, it's something that would become to define your whole year. You would spend however many months after talking about this issue and really exploring it. What was it about those initial accounts or that initial research that really grabbed you and made you want to continue this conversation?
Well, it was really the human side of the suffering that these people were going through. And it was one thing to read all the data, the collected data about the amount and statistics of rape going on in these places. And when we think about over 8 million women and children and men in the Congo who have been raped, you know, you really can't visualize that. It's really difficult to imagine 8 million victims of rape and sexual violence. How can I think of that? But when I heard some very particular stories, and this one story really stuck out to me. It was of this 12-year-old girl who was raped by her uncle and members, her friends, and she was held captive for several days, and they ended up actually paralyzing one of her legs because they bent it so wide. But what ended up happening is she sought out the justice system in the Congo, and that's very rare because the concept of being able to go and seek justice isn't something that's widely ingrained in these areas. It's really difficult to come across. And when they talked to her and when I was reading the transcript, she said that she wanted to make sure that her brothers and sisters didn't think that it was okay for a Congolese woman to be raped and for there to be nothing done about it. And just hearing that, the bravery of a 12-year-old girl, it just really, it shook me. And it really kind of contextualized that, you know, it's this suffering times 8 million in just one country. And we don't even know all the data. We don't know all the numbers because there's not enough research done about this issue. And you have to multiply that by all the countries affected. So Bosnia, you have Colombia, you have Cambodia. So all these countries together, it's a huge issue.
But there's little reporting of it, or it's very spotted?
Yes, it's spotted in a lot of areas too, and there's overall there's a lack of research on sexual violence, and as we're seeing from the Global Summit especially, a lot of talk has been the need for a demand for more research. So the demands for research, I think, have never been higher, but the way that we collect research and the actual collection of research has been really scant. We don't have a lot of literature on these things. And one of the things that I especially advocate for is the issue of men and boys, male victims of sexual violence. And there's almost no literature on how many men are affected by sexual violence in places like Uganda or the Congo. And there are a lot of barriers to research that we don't really think about. For example, in many of these areas, sexual violence, if you're a male and you're a victim of sexual violence, you're treated like a criminal before you're treated like a victim, because reporting sexual violence if you're a boy can actually bring upon charges of homosexual conduct. And that's a huge barrier for research in general and just for finding access to justice and redress.
And that plays a role in the paper that you ended up authoring and presenting. Tell me a little bit about that paper and how it came about.
So my paper was really a collection of research that was done from a few different institutes, and it was really kind of a collection from sociology, neurobiology. And what I had done is I collected this research and I'd compiled it with a hypothesis that it was all connected in some way. So what we had actually seen was an increase in violence, of more brutal and sadistic violence in the Congo that was actually characterized as rape with extreme violence, and that includes gang rape and torture. And what we'd actually seen is more women and victims coming forward saying that their attack was brutal, increasingly sadistic. And on the opposite side, we had seen more combatants and perpetrators come forward saying that they liked seeing their victims suffer and they liked perpetrating that kind of horrific acts. So it was kind of like I kind of saw the connection between the two that, well, why is there more perpetrators saying that they like to commit more brutal acts of violence and we're also seeing more victims coming forward? There must be a connection. So my paper really dove into the impressionability of children and that it really starts with children. So children witnessing high thresholds of violence continuously. And we kind of see that in the United States with video games, that there's that conversation going on that if more children play violent video games, then they're going to become more aggressive. And in the Congo, there's a very extreme example of that. And that's where children view high thresholds of continuous violence, and they internalize that as anxiety and depression, and they externalize more aggressive behavior. And what's also affected is their gender socialization, so how boys treat boys and how boys treat girls. And it's so fascinating to see the trends and really to see the effects of violence, violence untouched, because in the Congo especially, it's almost as if violence has had a safe space to grow rapidly because there's been little intervention done on the government side and certainly in other governments. It's really been the NGOs like Physicians for Human Rights who have really been at the forefront of this battle against sexual violence. So when my paper really kind of discussed on the impressionability of children and how, you know, this violence might actually get worse if we continue to not intervene and we continue to not act.
And where was the paper presented?
So I presented the paper to a forum at the Human Rights Council in Vienna, and I also presented it to the G20 Youth Forum over in Austria.
And we're talking with Joel Davis, a recent U.S. youth representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict in London. Part of his mission is to get a conversation started about sexual violence and conflict among young people. Join the conversation at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter using hashtag Gulf Coast Live. A reminder that this discussion may not be appropriate for younger audiences. So after you presented your paper this summer, you did end up as the only youth representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict. And what was your role as a youth representative?
So my role was to really advocate from the perspective of the youth in the United States for acting on sexual violence in conflict. And in the United States, when we talk about sexual violence, it's a hot topic right now. There's no denying the recent military sexual assault conversation and discourse on sexual violence in college campuses and universities. It's really, it's very much a hot topic, and it's a hot button for many Americans right now, especially youth. And my job was to really take that to the next level at this global summit, at this world stage, and advocate it also from the perspective of sexual violence in conflict, where sexual violence is used as a weapon systematically, which is totally different than really we think of the sexual violence that occurs in the United States. But I think it's also important to note that sexual violence in conflict zones, when I talk about this with a lot of people, they question a lot, why am I so focused on sexual violence in conflict instead of sexual violence that's occurring here at home? Why do I care so much about a country that's thousands of miles away that I've never been to? But sexual violence in conflict is just a very extreme representation of the sexual violence that occurs in peacetime. And it's a mistake to think that the sexual violence occurs in some kind of vacuum where there's no connection to the environment around it that creates this, because sexual violence just exploits the vulnerabilities of a society. So what I mean by that is if you don't respect women in peacetime, you're not going to protect them in conflict time. And if you don't create a safe space for men to come forward and report sexual violence without being stigmatized in peacetime, how would you expect them to act the same in conflict? So it's really two chapters of the same book working with sexual violence. So I'm not, you know, turning my back on my country, for example, and focusing on sexual violence in conflict and, you know, turning away from the sexual violence that's occurring here. But it's just two sides of the same story, and they both need to be told.
Is that a reaction that you've heard from people stateside, that this is a problem that happens far away, it doesn't affect me, I can't even do anything about it?
It is, I think, a reaction to some people that – I think the biggest reaction that I've had when I talk to people about this is, you know, who are you to care? Or, well, you're so young, what can you possibly add to the conversation? And I think that's a huge mistake, to discount young people. And I think that young people are consistently – reduced to social media activism every time they want to get involved with any issue. Back in 2012, the hot topic of the day was Kony 2012. And the way that youth all over the United States got involved with that is through Twitter. And the way that adults, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but many adults that I've come into contact with, the way that they really view youth being valuable is they're only legitimate on Twitter or on Facebook by rallying each other through social media activism. And it's really disappointing because there's no spaces created for us to really come forward and to speak. So when I talk to people or when I go up to people with other youth who really care about this issue, you're fighting a battle to first get involved to actually have a conversation with these people. You're fighting a battle going in and you have to fight a battle when you're there. So it's a lot harder, the challenges that youth face to stay involved and to get involved, but it's something that needs to be done. And when I had a conversation with the UN Under Secretary General Zeynep Bengura, who's the special representative of the Secretary General on sexual violence, she told me that it's always important to remember that at the banquet table there are no reserved seats. So that means that, you know, the adults or, you know, ministers, heads of state, they say how much they want youth participation. So we're going to give it to them. So we're just going to walk into the door and sit down and present our recommendations and show up. And here we are. We're part of the conversation now. And it's important for youth everywhere to do that.
How did you feel that your voice was heard in your capacity as a youth representative?
I think most people were a little bit cautious, honestly, when they were talking to me. It was very welcoming after I started talking to them about my experiences and my thoughts on sexual violence. And certainly people with the people at Physicians for Human Rights, they have been great with connecting me to a lot of people, and they really took me seriously, and that was fantastic. But a lot of people who I didn't know and I introduced myself to, there was an unseen barrier there that I really had to work to break through. I had to take about 10 or 15 minutes to really work through that barrier before they let their guard down and viewed what I had to say as legitimate. And I think for a lot of youth, that barrier is there in all sorts of capacities. And it's really difficult because that's the barrier that needs to be taken down.
And what was the U.S.'s participation and presence like at the summit?
So I met the U.S. delegation when I was there on Wednesday. So that was already 3 days into the summit. And it was interesting to see the United States' role there. And I won't go as far as to say as they were there at every meeting or they were there in every session or they participated as much as I would have liked them to. And I actually did take some time to hunt them down, to really try and find them to see where they were. It was disappointing, I'm not going to lie. It was disappointing to see the lack of participation on behalf of my government and then to turn around and see in newspapers that it seems to be a big collaboration between the United Kingdom and the United States. And that's not to say that the United States doesn't care. It's not to say that we're apathetic when it comes to sexual violence in conflict in the Congo or in Uganda or in Bosnia. But it's to say that so much of government, there seems to be a lot of side conversations that's going on that really isn't brought to the attention of everybody, and there's not a lot of participation from NGOs and youth in those side conversations. And there's a big disconnect because of that. There's a big feeling of disconnect.
And I know that, you know, you've seen both how organizations work one-on-one mm-hmm. with victims of sexual violence, with NGOs being on the ground, and you've seen how it's discussed on a global platform. Do you see on a big stage it reflecting the realities of it on the ground or how the conversation is framed?
I wouldn't say so. And I followed a lot of conversations after the summit just with NGOs and what they were talking about and hearing what they had to say. And there was a lot of criticism going on that the way that the summit was set up, that there was a fringe that was separate from all the expert sessions that were going on. And in that fringe, it was almost like a physical barrier. They placed all the NGOs there. So they were physically separated from where the ministerial and where the expert sessions were going on. So in those areas, a lot of NGOs felt like it wasn't properly reflecting the realities. And I know they use the hashtag time to act during the summit and during the global summit and after the global summit. And a lot of people felt like, well, I've been acting this whole time. You know, where have you been? And it was really interesting to hear that kind of conversation because truly NGOs are at the forefront of this. It's the NGOs who have been providing supplies, providing trainings a lot, sometimes in really good collaboration with their government. But NGOs are the ones who are working in these capacities. And I've seen it firsthand. The people who dedicate their lives to doing these extraordinary feats of selfless humanitarian work. And it's so inspiring to me. And it was sometime during my internship for working for Physicians for Human Rights, just seeing how they can continue going to work every day, working, you know, to help solve a problem in a country that's been going on for over 20 years and still go in with the same enthusiasm day after day. And it just really struck me. It was so profound. And I realized that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I would dedicate myself to this.
Get in touch with Joel Davis. He's an 18-year-old from Port Charlotte and a recent U.S. youth representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict in London. Part of his mission is to get a conversation started about sexual violence and conflict among young people. And I know that we have a tweet from Mary, who says, Joel is a great example for all young, old, and middle-aged people. We should all be proud of this young man. Thank you for your comment, Mary. I know that I'm sure other countries had more than one youth delegate. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you about, you know, the youth here and their understanding or concentration on this issue? And how do you get that conversation started?
Well, so, you know, going to the point that other countries may or may not have more youth delegates there, and what does that really mean? I wouldn't go so far as to say that it doesn't mean that there's a lack of caring for youth, you know, on the youth side in the United States. It doesn't mean that youth everywhere just don't care about sexual violence and conflict, and I happen to be just the only one who happened to care. But I think that, you know, the reason that I knew about the summit back in September is because I was working with a human rights organization, and a lot of youth, you know, don't have that kind of access to information because it's not widely dispersed or talked about here. It's not talked about in schools that rape is used as a weapon of war in some cases, and rape isn't just sexual desire. And I think I wanted to talk a little bit about that. In the United States, the rape is seen as something that's completely different where it is in other places, where here rape is too often associated with sexual desire. And on college campuses, the people who are trying to bring to the attention of others that this is really an epidemic, that this is going on, I think that they're too often painted with the broad brush that they're sensational or that they're alarmist or that they're being too activist, and then they need to calm down because they're too sensitive to these issues. And the people who try to degrade activism like that, you know, that what ends up happening is you get discouraged. You get discouraged from acting out. You get discouraged from speaking out. And it makes it difficult for you to search for these other opportunities to want to be involved like this. So I could totally see how, you know, youth in the United States, it doesn't mean that they don't care, but, you know, they've been put down so many times. And I will say that having a conversation about sexual violence that's going on in the United States is a lot harder to have than sexual violence going on in the Congo. And that's for a particular reason, because sexual violence that's occurring in the United States, it's happening because of very, very subtle, you know, vulnerabilities in society that when you talk about them to try and bring them to light, you know, people paint you as being overly sensitive and alarmist, where in the Congo, it's an obvious part of the problem. You know, every armed group uses rape as a weapon.
And that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us, Joel. Joel Davis is an 18-year-old from Port Charlotte and a recent U.S. representative at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict in London. Information is at WGCU.org. Please continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. For Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui, I'm Topher Forges. Have a great afternoon.